for the invitation. It's great to be here. I have to apologize. I will not be here tomorrow, unfortunately, because we are doing the Ride to Conquer Cancer from Toronto to Hamilton to Niagara. And I will be participating together with 16 other members on our team. So what I will try to present is some of our experience from integrating different kind of data, especially focusing on protein-protein interactions and especially focusing on cancer research, but it will apply to different kinds of high-dimensional data sets. As was mentioned earlier today, there are many data sets that can be represented or extended or integrated using the graph. So one of the tools that I will be presenting is Navigator, which is a tool for the visualization and analysis of large graphs. By large, meaning something that can actually scale with the domains that we are trying to represent. And so on the graph that you are looking at, we have 1.7 million edges and about 30,000 nodes in a graph. Most of the existing packages will not handle it. Navigator can handle this kind of representation. So going back to cancer, what we are trying to do is to take high-throughput data from microarrays, microRNAs, proteomic analysis, sequencing data, and apply different kind of algorithms that will help us to find predisposition for the disease, but also find and diagnose the disease earlier, and also plan treatment for individuals. The way we try to do that is to combine these multidimensional data sets with some sophisticated data mining, machine learning, statistical algorithms. Obviously, we need combination of those algorithms because there are different types of data that we need to integrate and learn a model that will help us to predict for diagnosis, prognosis, or better treatment planning. However, again, as mentioned earlier today, because we deal with the data where we have up to, say, 50 or 100,000 variables, but we have usually only hundreds or thousands of patient samples, we have a significant problem with overspecified systems. So what is really important is testing and validation. And I will have some points why this is even more important. So really what we are trying to do is to actually overcome the problem that we face in any kind of complex disease like cancer. Early diagnosis, reasonable survival. Late diagnosis, very bad survival. So what we can do to improve it overall is really to find some biomarkers to detect the disease before there are symptoms available. Many people tried by profiling, for example, blood serum directly using mass spectrometry from cancer patients and from normal control patients and trying to identify what's different. These studies basically failed. One of the reasons is that serum is very complex. There are a lot of technical reasons for complexity of these analyses or detection. And in a sense, it's really looking for a needle in a haystack. We don't know what we are looking for. We are trying to find something in a very complex situation. A better approach is to actually try to hypothesize what we need to find and then use different kind of very directed methods to find it. I will have example later on that. The other very important aspect is that once a patient has a disease, one way how we can try to improve the survival is actually to find way of predicting would this patient benefit from this treatment or not. If not, obviously most of these treatments are very toxic and we may improve their survival if we don't give them the treatment. On the other hand, in some cases, the treatment will be essential. And also even more, one treatment may not be enough. These diseases are very heterogeneous. You may need to apply multiple types of treatment. Obviously, all of this is nice. It's application to the clinical practice. But in order to really improve our way of designing new drugs, designing new treatments, we need to understand the biology of it. And it's one of the primary reasons why moving all of these different data sets and putting them in a context of pathways or these protein interactions is essential. The problem, you can go from cancer to cancer to cancer, but I will mostly use examples from lung and ovarian cancer, is that the signatures, prognostic or predictive signatures, usually don't overlap. What I mean by that is that you read paper A, and they say these genes are important and can predict survival. You read another paper, they have different sets of genes, and usually there is very little overlap among them. There were papers that suggested, for example, Endor paper in PNAS, that one of the reasons, obviously, is that we have many variables and few samples. So the suggestion was that, for example, in lung, we would need at least 1,000 samples before we can start seeing some kind of overlap. Makes sense to some degree. The other obvious reason is that there are different platforms, gene expression platforms, that are used for this profiling. There are different cohorts of patients. There are different analysis methods. There are different statistical methods for preprocessing and so on. And all of these obviously contribute to this heterogeneity. I will get back to two of the papers where I was involved that shed additional potential answers to why these signatures don't overlap. Suppose, though, that we find some overlapping signatures that make sense globally, and we can validate them on a different cohort of patients. The problem, in order to address the last point on the last slide, which is how to understand the biology, is that when we try to put it on this protein interaction network, 40% of these signatures do not have known interactions. And it's not number out of the air, it's actual number across lung, ovarian, prostate, and head and neck cancer. So the problem is that we don't have information to allow us to integrate this data set. We need to address it. Even if we address that point, we have another point, which is these protein interactions that are in the databases are binary. We know that these two proteins may interact under certain conditions to a certain degree. We don't know where, to what extent, under what conditions do they interact. We need to know these dynamics in order to really be able to use this information for predicting outcome or predicting response to treatment. Well, to be even more pessimistic, even if we solve that problem, we have the last one, which is in order to design new drugs, if we are successful up to that point, we need the structure of the protein, and PDB, database of structures, has only about 60,000 structures, far from what we really need. So there are many problems that we need to address. Obviously, we are in the process of trying to address them and not wait for the next 10 years until more data is available. So going back to the signatures, this is one of the examples of what I mean by signatures not overlapping. This disconnected Venn diagram basically shows signatures and how many genes are present in those signatures. And as you can appreciate, the overlap is minuscule. You can focus on those overlapping genes, but they are not very good signatures. So intersection of these signatures is not a good signature. Union is worthwhile considering, and that's what we did in this paper, where we combine everything that was done up to that point with reasonable validation and prognostic usefulness in lung cancer, which was about 170 genes. Then we took a different technique using qualitative PCR and used a different cohort of 160 patients. And the hope was that one of these signatures will now work. Well, the answer was that none of them did. But now we had a data set where number of variables and number of samples were at least comparable. We applied different methods and eventually found different signatures that were useful. For the first time in lung cancer, we were able to actually take these signatures and validate them in different data sets. And thus, in a sense, we had the first relatively robust signature. Well, another aspect was to try to interpret what does it mean that the signatures don't overlap. So graph, again, nodes in a graph are proteins, edges represent interactions, binary interactions. Some nodes are of different color because they come from, and shape, because they come from different small sets of genes that have a prognostic value in lung cancer. So as you can see, as I mentioned earlier, the signatures don't overlap, but they are very close to each other. They share interacting partners, which means that biologically they are related. And that's one way why studying this protein interaction network is useful, because we can explain some of the biology, why these three genes or four genes are important and why these are also important. How does it relate to each other? How can we potentially treat them? If you look into some of these names, even without knowing too much about biology, many of these proteins are well known in cancer and well known in lung cancer specifically. So we know that we are hitting some relevant area of biology. But the other thing is very important to notice. If you look into the protein like ACK or HIF1-alpha or STAT1, one of the things is apparent. It has a lot of the dots around. It has many interacting partners. They're relatively well-studied proteins. You can look then onto these poor guys on the side, and they have very few dots around, very few interacting partners, and they are not connected to the rest of the network. What does it mean? Are these outliers that are not important? Or likely or very plausible hypothesis, because they have so few interactions, they are not well studied, and they need a lot more interactions before we know how they relate to the rest of this biology. So not only we can integrate existing signatures on a protein interaction network, but through these analyses, we can actually identify what should the next experiment be for the mass spectrometry, yeast two hybrid, and other methods that can elucidate protein interactions. Well, to move forward, we can do two things. We can get more signatures and integrate them, which is the first part, but we can also integrate more interactions, both predicted and high throughput and from the literature. Well, if you look into this graph now, it looks like a budding yeast, but it's a human protein interaction network, and it's not extremely helpful for you to understand what's going on in these lung cancer signatures. Well, one of the ways then, we can use graph theory and extract how these individual components of these signatures are directly connected and how they relate to each other. And we get relatively nice, simple, planar graph. All of the diamond-shaped nodes are at least in one of the signatures that have been presented on the previous spreadsheet, and they show basically that they are directly interacting with another member from a different signature. And again, if you look quickly through what are the members of these signatures, you identify many cancer-related and also many lung cancer-related genes and proteins. And again, what you can identify is that there are many interacting proteins that are not singletons, but still they are not connected to the rest of the network, likely because we don't know how they are interacting with other proteins. So as I mentioned earlier, the number I mentioned earlier, this 40%, is not out of the blue. What we try to do in these four different cancers is to go through the literature and collect all of the data set and all of the signatures that were available. And so it basically goes across different types of studies and identifying which genes are up or down regulated in these individual experiments. You notice that these numbers, for example, for ovarian and prostate are relatively large because it's basically half the genome. But one has to consider that out of all of these different experiments, many are comparing different cell lines or are comparing response of cells to the treatment or are comparing cancer versus metastasis or cancer versus normal and so on. So it's different biology related to prostate cancer. So there's a global repository of what is... Yes. Kinases are a smaller number. Yeah.
They are many of them, like the macronases, are related to cancer.
Yes.
So how many, what percentage do you have in the different types?
In
for lung cancer, there are only 6, 8, just so.
Sorry. These are, the first part is individual analysis. The second part is differentially expressed genes. So it's 1,500 genes in lung cancer and 12,000 genes in prostate cancer. So the first number, 61, 119, 26, this is number of different analyses or different studies that we integrated. So we've been, and one of the things I should exemplify is that really that this is half of the genome. This is a relatively small number. But what was really amazing to me is that if you try to take then those differential genes and see what do we know about their potential protein interactions, the number is very consistent across these different numbers. We roughly, in average, it's 40% of those genes that are differentially regulated in these cancers, we have no interactions in the database. And that's quite disturbing because what can we do? Well, one of the things we can do, actually I should go through the animation. One thing we can do is to use text mining and also association mining to predict these interactions that we don't know. So through the first analysis, we identify what should we know about these cancers, and in a second one, at least we can hypothesize how these individual proteins are interacting or how they link to each other. These individual parts, and I will return to the algorithm itself, basically just shows that yes, we can do prediction, and for many, not huge number, but at least for a relatively large number of these individual signatures, we can predict how they relate to each other. So we have at least testable hypotheses for future experiments. So what we try to do with this really pipeline is to first identify signatures. So we identify the context. Why do we care? Maybe I should mention, if money and time is no concern, we can just do them all. But usually it is not arbitrary. And this at least will allow us to focus on the most important genes to study further. We can then predict and collect interactions from known and predicted sources, and then we can go into prioritized validation. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, there is no single algorithm that will allow us to do that, and also there is no single database or resource that will allow us to do that. So we have to integrate different types of pathways from reactomes through Wiki pathway, different protein interaction databases, different tools for visualization and analysis of these data sets, different annotation databases, including PubMed and protein structure, and so on and so forth, so we can move into really directed hypothesis-driven validation and screening for the experiment. So one of the, all of these basically tools and resources are useful for the integration. The first part, Cancer Data Integration Portal, as I mentioned earlier, it's not as useful to look at 12,000 genes, but if you run your own study, it is useful to be able to go quickly into it and say, well, in our study, we identified genes ABC. Genes ABC, where were they up and down regulated in ovarian, lung, prostate, and head and neck cancer? So we can put them in a context very quickly through database search of why they are potentially deregulated and how does it relate to the previous research. We can link it to the protein interactions by linking them together, and thus, even though gene A and B are different, they still might be part of the same pathway or biological complex, and thus relevant biology. We can also annotate them with gene cards or other databases that will tell us a little bit more about their function, about the processes they are involved in, and so on and so forth. So all of these will now move from just doing the analysis of biological data to actually generating hypotheses for future biological experiments. I mentioned that there are several technical and other reasons why the signatures don't overlap. Well, for integrating these different lung cancer signatures, one of the hopes from NIH and NCI, National Cancer Institute, was let's try to reduce the heterogeneity that we deal with. So instead of trying to solve all of the lung cancers, let's focus on a histologically more homogeneous subgroup of lung adenocarcinomas in early stage. We know that we have small numbers, so let's go after 500 samples. We have different platforms, so let's use Affymetrix U133. Preprocessing also changes what and how you can identify, so let's use the same preprocessing. At that stage, then we divert, and we started to use different analyses, and we tried to use the blinded validation. The whole idea was the cancers were coming from four different centers. Two were used for training, and two were used for blind testing. One of the caveats, in the sense of this study, is that they wanted to show how this kind of analysis can work across different centers. More appropriate statistical analysis would be actually to put all of the samples together, randomize, and then create two different sets for training and testing. That wasn't done, and unfortunately, I will show you some results why that's problematic. But one of the other important things I wanted to highlight, which is level of preprocessing. What we run into is if you use RMA or if you use Mas5 or if you use other type of normalization, everything changes. It's very important to use the same protocol for this analysis. It may sound weird, but recently, not even a month ago, there was a paper from NCI in the Journal of National Cancer Institute by a famous statistician, Richard Simon, who actually criticized some of the analysis, but he used very different protocol from what was described in the method. So it's not something, some mistakes that are not done. They are done on a higher level. What I wanted to show here is that there are different centers that provided samples and that profiled these samples. And if you look into what is on the right side, which is improperly normalized set of samples, you notice that Harvard samples look quite different. If you look into properly profiled samples, all of the samples look more similar because they have they are similar kind of histology and similar kind of grade of the cancer. If you look into correlation plots, again, if you improperly normalize, you see very strong side effect where the samples are coming from, which you can significantly suppress if you properly normalize the data. But the important thing to highlight here is also the strategy of processing and what I mentioned earlier is randomization versus different size comparison. So when we got the data for the training set from two different sites, one of the strategies we like to do is to do complete unsupervised clustering. And we got really nice results with all of the probes, nicely separated samples, very different from and independent from the clinical factors. So it seems that now we just need to reduce the dimensionality and we will have a reasonable signature. Because stage, as expected, would have a correlation with the survival. Differentiation wasn't a strong factor, and histology in a similar way. But really the wrench into the wheel was when we looked into separating Moffitt samples from Michigan samples, they actually separated even stronger in terms of the survival. So basically what we were able to find is that there is a site difference between the samples. And this is precisely one of the reasons why the earlier proteomic studies of trying to identify serum markers, biomarkers, for separating ovarian cancer from normal patients failed, because there was very strong site or protocol bias in this data set. So they did find that these samples are different from those samples, and those were cancer, those were not cancer. But it was not because cancer, no cancer, but it was because this was processed one way and somewhere else, and this was processed another way somewhere else. So one has to be very careful of what are the confounding factors that clustering or any kind of data mining analysis will identify. So not everything is so bad. What we try to do, as I mentioned earlier, is to reduce the dimensionality by going through two levels of analysis. First, identify what are the important signatures, create a union, and create a different data set on a different cohort with a larger number of patient samples. We mined it first time, we identified three genes, and then we thought, well, is this all that we can find from this data set? And one of the relatively simple approach created by one of my past students, Paul Boutros, was to basically try an iterative approach. First, let's rank the genes based on how they can separate patients into clinically interesting subgroups based on the survival. Then let's take the best pair of genes, and we can identify using K-medians clustering how they separate the samples. If we are not finding an improvement from the previous round, we are finished. We have the smallest, best signature we can find through this iterative process. If there is an improvement, we can try one more gene and basically go through this iteration, find the best pair, best triplet, best quadruplet, and so on. After we find the best signature, we stop and we are happy. So this way, we found a six gene, or Paul found a six gene signature. Interesting, there was also overlap with the three gene signature that we find initially. But we were then a little bit baffled again. It's the same data set, different type of analysis. We found two different signatures that partially overlap. Just the overlap is not good enough. You need either the three or you need the six genes in order to get a good performance. But again, as with the three gene signature, we were able to validate on different available, different independent data sets. We also created one larger data set with almost 600 samples across eight different studies. And again, significant differences based on the signature. So the question was, well, again, is this the best we can find, or is this the only signature that we can find? In order to address this, we used the power of Linux cluster to generate 10 million random six gene signatures, and to identify how well they can separate individual patient samples. And what is interesting is that we found significant enrichment that many of these random signatures are actually as good or better than our signature identified through this modified steepest descent algorithm. So from this set of about 113 genes, 1,700 or almost 1,800 signatures perform better on this external validation data set. And so if you start with 40,000 probes, it's not unreasonable to think that you can find 500,000 easily signatures that would have the same performance. Now, on one side, you may say, well, why would you need to know all of the signatures? But from a clinical viewpoint, if you have one set of six genes and another set of six genes, it may not be the same in order to go with that gene into the clinical practice for the test. Some may work better than the other. So from a clinical viewpoint, we would like to know, if not all, at least most of these good signatures. So then we can use other criteria to select that, okay, out of these, we will pick these to go for FDA approval for clinical practice. Well, 10 million random permutations takes a while, even from a small data set. From a large data set, it would be really computationally intractable, at least at the present time. So question would be, how can we find these signatures in a different way? Well, we try to annotate them using the pathways, using the interaction, but nothing seems to yet come of what the heuristic algorithm would be to find most of these signatures through significantly less computationally intensive tasks. But what we could do is actually to identify frequently occurring genes in these signatures. So you have almost 2,000 different signatures, but many genes are in most of these signatures. And that's what the plot shows, is that actually a very small fraction is almost in half of these signatures, and then it kind of trickles down. So we can look into what are the important components of these signatures. And that was a quite disturbing finding, because these genes were not the most differential genes. Most of the methods that are currently used, statistical machine learning or data mining, are trying to identify what are the most differential genes between the groups. Well, these 16 genes are not the most differential signatures, yet they are critical to be part of many of these good signatures. So we started to call them best supporting actors, because the signatures need them, but we cannot find them using current methods. So after we map them into the protein interaction networks, original list, the signatures from 16 and 6 genes, and the original 3 gene list, highlighting what are the direct interactions and how they relate to each other, again, they are quite interconnected. And that might be one of the answers. They are different, but there is some mechanism how they need to connect to each other. You also notice that there are some indirect partners like P53, MYC, and so on, again, very well known in cancer in general, that are not part of the signature, but are connected actually to 4 members of the signature. So in a sense, there might be these inflection points or articulation points in these networks that are not part of the signature, but are connected to many members of these signatures. So if we take the 2 graphs together, going across a large number of different lung cancer studies and going through this exhaustive or close to exhaustive permutation analysis, and we combine them together, again, what is interesting is that we find that they are highly interconnected. So one can start speculating is that you can either do large number of individual studies across large cohort of patient samples, or you can do large number of permutations, and then eventually you start really zooming in onto what is likely important in lung cancer. But again, the same aspect comes, we need more interactions. So in order to answer all of these different questions, there are many tools that we created or we used during the analysis. One of them is interaction database that combines high throughput and predicted interactions. The other is different pathways from KEG and Reactome that can tell you how these individual molecules are signaling together, how they work together. Obviously, PubMed is a nice resource of 18 million plus articles that describe biology behind it. GeneCart is an excellent resource when you need to understand what individual genes are doing and what resources are available for its further study. The problem, though, is that it's gene at a time as opposed to more computationally intensive analysis. Protein databank or protein structure database for understanding the three-dimensional aspects of these molecules. Different signatures across different cancers from cancer data integration portal, and potentially different data sets from siRNA or microRNA experiments that can be integrated using protein interaction network data analysis. As I mentioned earlier, if, for example, in a prostate cancer, 13,000 genes is not necessarily very useful, but what we can do is that we can look only in significantly up and down regulated genes across larger number of studies, and it significantly reduces down to smaller number. We can obviously overlay it with pathways and identify which pathways are now relevant to these signatures, but we can also do analysis across comparative genomic hybridization data or look through largely deregulated genes or genes that are deregulated in a certain direction, and what's the overlap between amplification of the chromosomes and so on and so forth. So we can use this really as a resource for quickly zooming in and out and doing data mining in order to generate new hypotheses for further experiments. To highlight how these protein interactions with this kind of resource can be useful, I don't have time to go into the details of this method, but I just wanted to highlight that what's the state of the art. In ovarian cancer, there were 2 major papers that published a large number of micro-experiments, around 230 and 260. They used internal validation, where they were able to separate patients based on a signature into significantly different subgroups. But the problem was that if they applied it to the independent data set, it didn't work. So what can you do? Well, one of the things is to combine the data from the multiple 61 different studies and identify which genes are highly deregulated in many different studies, put them in a protein interaction network, identify what's relevant, and generate a signature. In this case, our signature is performing here, then validated into this large independent data set, and it's performing better than any of the other signatures that were recently published in a GeneSeqDB from Harvard that collects 41 different signatures for ovarian cancer. So I wouldn't say that this is the answer, but by integrating data across many different studies in a novel way through protein interactions enables us to find signatures that perform better than whatever was found so far. There is one signature from the literature that performs quite well, at least in one of the data sets, but the problem is that it's not completely independent because some of the samples that were used for training and also are in the testing data set. And it's another point I wanted to highlight, which is very unfortunate that, first of all, not all data sets are available because some journals are not requiring it for submission. And the second is that sometimes people publish a data set, then yank out subset of samples, publish another data set. And sometimes it's not clear of what samples are in both data sets. So sometimes what might seem as an independent validation is not really an independent validation. And there was a term that I really like that was coined recently by two statisticians from MD Anderson, which is called forensic bioinformatics. And basically what they do is that they go through published data sets and published papers, and they try to find any kind of possible flaw that disvalidates claims or results that are presented. Bagley and Coombs are their names. So I think this is going to be a quite fruitful area of research of how to identify what's wrong with what is already published. And it's not obviously for the purpose of kind of mocking down the authors, but it's really for the purpose that there was a study from Duke University in lung cancer that was really pushing to start a clinical trial on their findings. And because of this forensic bioinformatics, actually the trial was stopped because the findings were not what they claimed, because of the errors that were made. And some of the errors authors actually kind of apologized for, and they said it was a clerical error, that some of the columns in the table shifted. Well, in a clinical data, that's a humongous error. You are either cancer patients or you are not. It's not clerical error. So basically for, actually I should speed up, what I mentioned earlier is really just highlighting that we need these signatures because there is many of them that we need to understand and we don't have interactions that integrate it. There was a recent, last year, in Nature Methods paper that tried to combine five different high-throughput methods for experimental detection of protein interactions. And basically what they found is that they individually, their sensitivity is to only identify 25 to 35% of interactions that are so-called gold standard. Even if you create a union of what these five methods get identified, it's only 59%. So what are we going to do? Are we going to use 10 different methods and 50 different methods and try to plow through this data? We require a huge amount of resources and time. The other approach is that we can also use existing data, be smart to identify what do we need to know, what likely is involved, and then go for validation as opposed to blind screening. And my analogy for this is almost like if you have a dark room and you want to shoot a target, it's a dark room. You can take a machine gun and try to spray it throughout and hopefully you will hit something, or you can have a flashlight point and then shoot with one bullet and be exactly where you need to be. So the approach that we took was take all of the proteins that are in a SwissPro database, which includes full length and also fragments, and basically determine all possible pairs across these and determine how likely they are to interact. The approach we took was that we have a relatively large number of interactions that people would agree are true interactions, so are true positives. We randomly selected proteins that are likely to interact. Obviously, in biology, there is nothing that you can say, no, these do not interact, because even if you try 10 different methods, it still doesn't mean that the proteins do not interact, but it's the likelihood that they are interacting is low. And then take as much information as we can from anything that we can, from gene co-expression, ortholog, domains, gene ontology, structural information, post-translational modification, and basically create a large vector for each pair and for each protein, and use association mining. Can we find some links between different values for different attributes that highly correlate with protein interactions or that highly correlate with non-interactions? Because we try to predict both. We try to predict that proteins do not interact and that proteins do interact, and then we can basically try to summarize it, what is the potential of these two proteins physically interacting. Obviously on this score, yes? Yes, but that would not be very useful. There are many problems where you have very skewed distribution of the data, and it's true that yes, you can say no for everything and you will be right, but your true positives will be very low. And so you want to increase the true positives by not increasing the false positives too high. So you still try to predict protein interactions. But there are two cases. This is one of the highlights of what is really happening, is that obviously you can, what would be the score if you have a probability 0 to 1 of two proteins interacting? What would be the score that you would say, well, now I will believe this and I will be very weary about believing the other part? Because obviously as you decrease the score, you significantly increase number of interactions that you are predicting. And that's part of how are you going to evaluate or calibrate your prediction. Also, there are different, in a sense, algorithms and different attributes that are used for prediction. And each of them will contribute up to a certain level, including topology of the network and so on. But you can see that many of them, like for example, topology from the graph, are useful up to a certain point and then they stop to be useful because now you are going into the parts of the graph that is very sparse. If there is no structure in the graph, you cannot really use it for prediction and so on. But the important message from this is that none of the individual attributes are extremely well behaving and many are relatively poor. But it's important is that if you combine them all, you actually get pretty nice curve for how well they perform in terms of true positives and false positives or precision and recall. Let me speed up. There are blue lines now represent the newly predicted interactions by one of my students, Max Cotillard. And these green and red are two different comparisons for kind of state-of-the-art computational predictions of protein interactions from the literature. This comparison of protein interactions, this comparison of proteins. So the important part is if we predict the same number of proteins or same number of interactions, we have significantly lower false positive rate compared to this method. If we use the same false positive rate, we predict a lot more proteins and a lot more interactions. So compared to where we are, we have a better coverage and we have also better accuracy of this prediction. The other potential evaluation of this prediction is to use the same gold standard I mentioned earlier from the Nature Methods paper. So the original authors used 5 different methods. This is a 92 gold standard protein interaction pair, and this is a randomly selected pair for control. Basically, the green squares represent given method detecting the protein interaction. And as you can see, really small fraction of interactions are detected by all methods. Many are detected by only one method. And importantly, large fraction, 41%, is not detected by any of these 5 methods. Obviously, there are other methods like mass spectrometry that could be used and so on. But the point is that this space is very sparse or completely empty. And these experiments are quite expensive. So computationally, we actually cover a relatively large area. And if you compare it really as a fraction of detected proteins, we detect 97% with very small false positive rate, which is very comparable to the other data mining methods. I will not go into the details of what else we can do with this analysis or with this in order to finish relatively on time. But one of the things is you can also use additional information to highlight of does it really make sense? Is it biologically plausible what we are predicting? So as I mentioned earlier, it's basically 75,000 by 75,000 matrix predicting the probability of interaction. This is using the Navigator visualization tools where you can put any given protein in a center and then all of the other proteins around it. So it's basically 75,000 proteins in it. And the length of the edge is inversely proportional to the probability of interaction. So the more likely they are interacting, the closer they are. The less likely they are interacting with it, the further they are. And you can go across all of the proteins, it's exactly the same pattern, but most of the proteins are unlikely to interact with any given protein, and few are likely and less likely, and so on and so forth. So we have this concentric circle going further. So one quick way is to basically select only these closed members, combine with the data that we have already on known protein interactions in human, basically filter it on a 50% probability, and basically we are adding about 8,000 proteins, and we have now about 111,000 interactions. It's important because, as I mentioned, 40% of signatures do not have interactions, so 8,000 less of those 40%. We can use text mining for further validation. Again, not going into the detail, but we can extract, once we know what likely interacts, we can try to extract that information from the literature. So it's not, the task is a little bit simpler. It's not to extract automatically interactions from the literature, it's to use the literature to validate predicted interaction. And for that, actually, the specificity and sensitivity is pretty high. Importantly, though, we can also increase amount of evidence for existing interactions, because most of the curated papers and curated interactions that are in a curated databases will have one abstract per interaction. Here is the evidence that these two proteins interact. But it's useful to know that you can increase it to actually about 10 in average and have also more context for that interaction, or at least multiplicity of evidence. Let me skip through some of these. So the important kind of message from this analysis is that the most differential genes are not necessarily the best biomarkers. And how to find the best signatures for prognosis or diagnosis or prediction of response to the treatment is still a question to be found. Signatures do not overlap because many reasons. There is different processing of data, there are different patients, and all of these have to be considered. One of the other aspects that I didn't go into the detail is all of these analyses are basically a pipeline. You need to pre-process the data, you need to identify the most differential genes or the signatures and the validating and so on. The problem is that most of the time people consider this to be relatively linear. You take the best processing method there is out there. You take the best algorithm that is there for identifying